Good morning, we'll start. Okay, so what we'll do is today, we do have So good morning, we'll start because it's already time. And last week we did like a Hasidic concept on this, on the what the War of Midian represents. But today, before we go into the next story in the Chumash, which we'll do next week, I thought this week is Purim, so it's for one lesson. It's okay. We'll take a bit of a, you know, how do we say it? A detour. That's it. Exactly right. A detour, and we'll do something on the Megillah. Why not? It's always beautiful, no matter how many times. I mean, every year we read it again. So, must be that we have to relearn it. So, anyways, hopefully it'll be some at least something new. So what I've done is I've chosen one section that will look at some of the psukim. But before we go inside to the psukim that I've chosen, I just wanted to share one very nice concept these concepts, we hear them every year, but sometimes we just see them in a bit of a deeper light and a slightly different perspective. So when we begin the Megillah, that you don't have in front of you, in the first chapter of the Megillah, we start by discussing that Ahasuerus was the king of 127 countries, and we start by saying that he made this massive party, right? And it goes into incredible, incredible detail about the party that Ahasuerus makes. Now, just one thing to remember, that even though the Megillah is a story, and it's a story with a lot of detail, but we have to realize that this is one of the 24 books of Tanakh, which means that when it was written and put into, so to speak, the 24 books of Tanakh, it is done in a way which has to fit the format. What do I mean by the format? I mean that there's no extra verses. This is not just something to make it enjoyable to read or pleasurable for us, or more, you know, as we say, like with a movie, you know, more like 3D or more colors or more. That's not what it's about. If it's Tanakh, then it's holy. If it's holy, it means that every pasuk that's put in was thought out and has intent and has a lesson for us forever. So we have to understand why all the detail on the party, and I'll just read you in English even. I mean, I know we're going to read it this week on Thursday night, but I know you know, but you can see how it describes. It says like this. It says he made a feast for all his officials, and then it said, let's see how it, and it was 180 days. And what did he do? He says, let me just see. He says there were hang, and it describes. There were hangings of white, fine cotton, and blue wool, held with cords of fine linen and purple wool upon silver rods and marble pillars. The couches of gold and silver were on a pavement of green and white, and shell and onyx marble. The drinks were served in golden goblets, no two goblets alike, and royal wine in abundance according to the bounty of the king. Now, I mean, it's all very nice, and, you know, when we read a book nowadays, you read a novel, Avdil. I mean, yeah, you describe every, but this is not a novel. This is a holy book of Tanakh. So what does it matter to us? All the details of the party, and then it goes not only into the way they decorated the party, but how every person could choose what they drank and how much they wanted, and it wasn't coerced, and how many days the part. What's all the detail? What's the significance? Obviously, the significance in every detail, we're not going to go into that today. But what I want to know more is why the importance even of stressing the whole thing. It could have said in one pasuk, it could have said that Ahasuerus made a grand party and the Jewish people came, and, you know, that's where they, you know, they all came up with the idea of presenting Vashti, and then she was killed. You know, that's what we want to lead to. What's this whole thing? So to understand that, we have to understand another small, it's not small, but the big question that's always asked, you know, when Haman came up with his plan to destroy the Jewish people, we know that Haman hated the Jewish people. So we know what motivated him on a simple level. We experience it, unfortunately, exactly the same thing now. So we know what this means. But as Jews, we understand that Haman has no power on his own. If he was able to come up with this crazy plan and to convince Ahasuerus to listen to him, it must be that there's something deeper happening to the Jewish people. And the big question that the Gemara discusses is, what is it that the Jewish people did at that time that made them so vulnerable and that made it possible that a wicked Haman is able to make such a terrible decree upon them? So what answers do you have? Because there's always a few answers given. What did the Jewish people do, so to speak, that made them, that weakened their connection, so to speak, and their special protection that they have?
They fraternized with the others, not their own kind.
Okay, so how do you see that, Daisy? What do you see that in?
What do I see?
How do you know that? Like, what makes you say that?
Because that's what happened.
Because they were invited to the party.
Yes.
But also, half the furnishings you mentioned there and the goblets are all from the temple.
From the temple. Exactly, right? That's true. A lot of the special things that were displayed was from the Beis HaMikdash, 100%, which is unreal to think that that could be done at such a party, at such a disgusting party that was going on there. That's 100% true. But no, Daisy, what you're saying is 100% correct, and I just want to pick up on that. So it's the fact is they were invited to the party, it's true. But there's one thing to be invited, and the truth is nowadays we are also invited to join the world, right? We are, the world is open. Everybody's welcome to do whatever, I mean, in most places, at least until last year, we felt equal, right? And, you know, we can do go where we want. But that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, there's the attitude that we have, right? So the language that's used is not just that the Jewish people were invited or that they joined the party. The language that's used, yeah, is that they ate even more, that they nenu, that they had pleasure, enjoy. Nenu me su'udasai shel oisai rasha. That's the language used. They enjoyed the party of that wicked man. What does that mean, that they enjoyed the party? What is so terrible? Let's just say, and we know, you know, there's a very, most opinions hold that the party for the Jewish people, when they were invited, they were given their special meals. It wasn't like the Lewis's earline meals. It was the best of the best, but it was kosher, right? It was kosher. There was nothing unkosher about the food that they were given. Why are we not allowed to enjoy kosher food? If somebody offers you a free meal, why shouldn't you enjoy it? What?
The premises aren't kosher.
Oh, that's a very good, Rona. The premises. Okay. So we have a... The whole atmosphere is not kosher. What was the party celebrating? Why did he make a party?
Was it Haman's idea?
It was. Yes. It, believe it or not, maybe. But this, it's more about Achashverosh.
Was he boasting that he's the king of all these countries?
Exactly. And yes, his wealth. That's right, he's showing off. But why specifically then? What was he marking at that point? Something very big. It was the third year of his reign, and he was marking the fact, it's a very interesting thing that we don't realize that they knew about. We know there was a prophecy that was given by Yirmiyahu the prophet. And he said to the Jewish people that your temple will be destroyed. You will go into exile in the Babylonian exile, which will become the Persian exile. But you should know that after 70 years, you will be able to return to the land of Israel and the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt. Everybody, I mean, all the Jewish people knew this prophecy, but it wasn't just the Jewish people. It was also the all the advisors of the nations of the world, especially the nations who subjugated the Jewish people and who did not want the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. So they knew about this prophecy and they were keeping tab. When it got to the 70th year, that they thought was the 70th year, because there's different ways to calculate from when the Beis HaMikdash would be rebuilt. And I'll tell you why I say that, because the Jewish people, when they went into Golos, into Bavel, there were stages. It's fascinating. They didn't all go at once. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed on a certain year. However, even before that, 3 years before that, the important people of the Jewish people had already been taken, and the king of the Jewish people had already been taken into Bavel. So they counted wrong, and they thought the 70 years are over. Achashverosh was told by his advisors, the 70 years of the prophecy is over. Up until then, that prophecy was hanging upon his head, and he thought that as soon as it said the 70 years are over, well, the kingdom is going to be taken away from him, at least a part of the kingdom. He's going to be much less of an important man, because we know, fascinating, people don't realize, you know, you think of a Beis HaMikdash, a little temple in the place in the land of Israel. In the amazing thing was that all over the world, they used to come to travel to the land of Israel. The people of the world appreciated, valued, respected, and knew that there was something incredibly special that happened in Jerusalem when the Beis HaMikdash was standing, to the point that they would come and bring tributes, they would bring sacrifices, they would bring tributes, even if they had other gods, because they knew that there was something about that holy place that brought bracha to the world. Now, when Ahasuerus is told, the 70 years are up, and it passes, the time passes, and nothing happens, absolutely nothing, if you think about it. The Jewish people are living in Persia. There is no sign of them returning to the land of Israel. Not only that, but how are they living in Persia? More and more assimilated. Exactly. More and more part of the culture, more and more part of the people, to the point that it looks like they're not even yearning to go back. And we know it's true, they weren't. When, let's just fast forward for a minute, take a little diversion. When they were given permission years later after this, right? It wasn't that many years later. A few years later, by the son of Ahasuerus, Daryavesh said, you can go back. And Ezra was trying to encourage the Jewish people to come back to the land of Israel. Only a small percentage went. Many of the Jews remained in Babylonia, in Persia, whatever it was at the time. They were wealthy, they lived well, it was the seat of culture of the time. It was like the golden American Australian dream. I mean, that's what it was. They lived well. And the people actually didn't have a problem with them. It was no problem at all. So they didn't return. So the truth is that Ahasuerus was right. When he looked around, he said, these people are not yearning to go back. I have absolutely nothing to worry about. I am definitely the king over the whole world, and they've accepted me as the king. So he celebrated by making that party. And as you said, Riva, what did he do? He took out specifically the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash to show that nobody even cares anymore. Nobody's yearning, nobody's heartbroken about the fact that these vessels are in our hands and that we can use them in such a terrible way. So he makes this party. Now he invites the Jewish people. Now if you get an invitation to a party that is specifically marking that the exile is forever, so to speak, that you're not going back, that there's no return, that there's no more revelation of godliness, even if you still keep kosher and you still keep Shabbos and you still consider yourself a Jew, but you have that mentality that now you have to blend in and take upon yourself to live the natural way and to live like everybody else. That's a massive problem. And Mordechai told the Jew, that's why Mordechai told the Jewish people, don't you dare go to this party. This party is celebrating exactly what you shouldn't be celebrating, what you should be tearing your clothes over, what you should be mourning. And you can think that you can, not only did they go and they enjoyed the party, well, that was a problem, massive problem. So when you think about it, it sounds like, oh my gosh, how could they do that? But the truth is, it was more subtle than them saying outright, oh, we don't care about the Beis HaMikdash. It's not what they said. What they said and what they thought, in other words, when they went to the party, was more the approach that all of us really have, generally speaking. That if we live in a natural world, which we do, and we live in a country that's not our own, which we do, so we have to abide by the culture and the norms of the country we live in. If a king invites us to the party, it doesn't look right for us not to go. It could reflect badly on us. We can end up being, who knows what could happen to us? Who knows what he can decide to do? And it's actually a test. It's a difficult test. And it actually matches the whole mentality. So it's not just like a one-off thing. It's just a reflection of the way they were living. And Mordechai was trying to jolt them out of that. He was trying to say to them, listen, guys, it's true. When you live in a certain country, we have a thing, Dina de Malchus Adina. You live in a country, you keep the rules of the country. Yeah, of course, you do. You pay the taxes the way the country, you follow the laws of the country. Of course you do. But you don't adopt the way that they think. You don't take on their perspective. You don't look at the world that it runs itself and that there's no God, obviously. So we know that. But the Jewish people found it very, very challenging. And therefore, they went to the party and they enjoyed the party. And from there, everything went downhill very fast. Once that happened, that gave Haman the energy, the spiritual energy, to be able to plot against the Jewish people and to actually make the whole plan that he had, because in heaven, they had no defense. There was nobody the angels weren't able to defend the Jewish people. Because it's like almost like they said, it sounds like they want to be there. It sounds like they want to assimilate. So what should we do? Why should we stand up for them? Obviously, we thank God, Hashem does love us, as we say, unconditionally. So at the end of the day, Mordechai did manage to get the Jewish people to wake up, as we know. And then Hashem woke up himself, and a miracle did happen. But it took time, and it was in a more hidden way because of the way that everything was operating at that time. But now, understanding that introduction, I just want to go into a very fascinating thing. So now, coming back to the party, why all the detail of the party? Because if you think about what Achashverosh, what he was celebrating, could you imagine? He was celebrating that I finally got them. You know how they say? Every generation, we got those Jews. I got them. He thought he got them now. I mean, that's it.
The beginning of assimilation.
Yeah, it's one of the beginnings. But he thought he got them. Just like now, they think they got us. They think that's it. You know, many of these people think we're finished. That's it. It's over. It's over. It's no question. It's just a matter of time. It's over. Every time they think that, they get more empowered and more excited. And Achashverosh couldn't, nothing was enough. No expense was spared to show his feeling of victory that he got them. And this is it. They're over. The Jewish people are over, because the Jewish people are always a problem for the nations of the world in that way, if they want them to be. In other words, because what we represent sometimes is not what they want to live with. Right, as we know. Sorry, Sylvia, did you want to ask something? Yes.
It's not important, but it's just, I know that so few went back from Babylon. So few Jewish people.
Yeah.
So few actually went out of Egypt.
Okay, so that's interesting difference. So the difference, you're right, sounds like, but unfortunately in Egypt they died. And in Babylon, they didn't die, thank God. And the difference is that in Babylon, it's after the giving of the Torah. So what happened with the Jews of Babylon, it's all, as we know, there's always the free choice that we have. And then there's the master plan, you know, that takes place. You know, as we know, we're all a little bit like puppets, where Hashem has a grander plan. The truth is that the Jewish people staying in Babylon at the end was a good thing. Why? Why was it a good thing? It wasn't the right choice, perhaps, that they made. And if they probably would have all gone, Mashiach maybe could have come, and the second Beis Hamikdash could have been eternal. But once they made that choice, the fact that the Jewish people were in Babylon provided a safe haven afterwards when the Romans destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. You know, we have what we call the Gemara, the Talmud Bavli. In Babylon, they had centers of Torah learning, which was sometimes even greater than in Eretz Yisrael, because they weren't as persecuted. They lived more freely. And it's like now, sometimes when you have the money that comes, you know, from out of the land of Israel, that Israel needs. But we want it to be that Hashem should just, you know, finish with all of that already. But it's, you know, it's interesting how it works. It's fascinating. You know, there's a very interesting thing. It actually applies, but just a small thing applies this year. You know, this year Pesach is Erev Shabbos, you know. So there's a whole story how in the Gemara times, it's the time of the Mishnah, when the Beis HaMikdash was still standing, the second Beis HaMikdash, and one time it fell out like it did this year, where Erev Pesach was Shabbos, right? And the first night of Pesach would have been Matzah Shabbos, just like it's going to be this year. And all the Chachamim were discussing, and they couldn't remember what to do. When do you bring the Karban Pesach? That was a whole discussion. And who came? Do you bring it on Shabbos or not? And Hillel, that's when Hillel became great, came from Babylonia. That's where he had started out. And he had learned from the sages in Babylonia that you do bring the Korban Pesach on Shabbos, and he came to, and so he was able to teach the sages in Israel what the right thing was to do. Because in Babylonia, they were living much wealthier lives, and they were able to learn in a much better way, and therefore a lot less got forgotten. So it's actually fascinating how Hashem orchestrates everything. Sometimes the negative things are negative, but they have a positive side to them, as we know, and a purpose. So that's just a side thing. But you see that over here also, that's why. So they didn't. They didn't, it's true. But nevertheless, there's reasons. But as we know, the Jews that did return, they were, it was very special, and that's afterwards we had the story of Hanukkah in the land of Israel for those who did return. But yeah, at that time already there was Jewish communities in other areas, not just in Israel. Yeah, which is what like what we have now. Okay, but coming back now. So now, after that, I know you don't have these psukim. I just want to read you one or two more psukim. Let's see if I remember where it is in the perek. We have the famous, I just want to, and I'll show you some on the inside that you do have. The famous psukim that happened afterwards. So Mordechai stands up and he says it's not the way to behave. But the Jewish people do go to the party, and unfortunately the decree comes. And we know that that before the decree, I'll just read you two psukim. Let's see what he says. Okay, so it says that afterwards Achashverosh promoted Haman, and Haman became a very important person in the land, and it says everybody bow down. V'chol avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech, all of the servants of the king who were in the gates by the gates of the king, kairim u'mishtachavim, they would bow down. L'haman, why? Ki kein tziva le'hamelech, because the king commanded him. And we know the famous words, u'mardechai la'yichra v'la'yishtachaveh. Mordechai didn't bend and he didn't bow, right? That's the famous line that we know. He was different and he wasn't. And interestingly, what happens after, it says, Vayomru avdei hamelech, and the servants of the king said, which servants? Asher b'shar hamelech, those that were standing at the gate, the ones that were near Mordechai there, they would say to Mordechai, Madua ato eiveres mitzvas hamelech, why are you transgressing the command of the king? The king says you have to bow. And what did he say? He didn't answer. And the pasuk, it's interesting, if you notice, you'll see when they read the Megillah, there's no reply. He doesn't reply to them. And it says, Vayihi ba'amram, after they said it a lot of times to him, they kept on asking him, Eilav, yoyim v'yoyim, right, day after day, v'loy shama aleihem, and he didn't listen to them. Then after a while, Vayagidu l'Haman, they told Haman, they said to Haman, Lirais, to see, Haye amdu divrei Mordechai, would the words of Mordechai actually withstand? Ki higid lahem asher hu Yehudi. Because what did Mordechai say to them? He didn't give them any reasons, and he didn't say, he said, I am a Jew. And that's what they wanted to hear. What's Haman's reaction going to be? And what's the repercussion, so to speak? And does it matter if Mordechai is a Jew or not? Why does that have to do with him bowing or not bowing? That's what they also wanted to know. It's actually quite a fascinating thing. And then we know what happens. And Haman saw, and he was filled, Vayimale Haman Chema. And Haman was filled with tremendous, tremendous anger. Now, on your sheets, let me see, I wanted to number them, but of course I didn't. I'll show you what it looks like. It looks like this. The one that looks like this, the first one that looks like that. It says, Reish, Reish Samaches on the top. I'll show you something nice. I want to show you something beautiful about these words, that Mordechai didn't bow, he didn't bow down at all, and it's actually interesting. So the first thing we notice, if you look at it, it says, why, if you look on Reish Samaches, the first column, why does it say it in the future tense? If you think about it, La Yichra, the La Yishtachav is actually future tense. It should say, La Kara, he didn't bow, which is present tense. And instead it says it in the future. What does that mean? So there's a few answers that are giving. So the first one, if you see circled, B'sefer Manas HaLevi, it says, Shemashmos HaKosuv Loimar, Shemardachai Kibel Alatzmei Loimar, Zeis B'peh Molei, Shehu LaYichra V'LaYishtachave. This is fascinating, again, to the theme of what Mordechai is doing. Mordechai didn't just not bow when Haman walked by. Rather, Mordechai actually had a motto. he actually made an obvious, massive statement about it. And he said, I will not bow. Like it was like something that he, a mantra almost. And he said it. Not only did I not bow yesterday and I won't bow today, I will never bow down to Haman. And that's what he would go around saying. There's a fascinating discussion that there are many shiurim given about this, that, you know, we read the story sometimes quite quickly, and especially we hear it as children, and we sometimes don't think, rethink it as an adult. But if you stop for a moment and just think about something, so we think, wow, you know, the famous song that the children sing, that I will not bow down to anybody except for Hashem, and how amazing he is. But if you just stop for one moment and just think about it, you know, we have it now also. What was Mordechai doing by making this statement in such an obvious way, standing up against Haman? Do you think that the Jewish people were happy with Mordechai? Okay, it's quite an interesting. It's so amazing if you think it's protest, exactly, big protest. That's it. They were definitely. What are you crazy? Don't stick out. Why are you antagonizing? You know, don't make big statements. Just stand back a bit. It's what we say now, right? It's exactly what we say now. It's an amazing thing. What Mordechai did was not popular at all. It was actually the most unpopular thing that he could have done. He had many people who were, and actually, not only many people angry, but when Haman came out with his decree, they blamed Mordechai. They said, you see what your actions did? That's why we're going to die. Because you didn't bow. If you would have just bowed, or, okay, you don't want to bow, I understand. Don't go there. Hide. Who says you have to be there? Who says you have to stand there? Who says he has to? You should make it that he doesn't notice? Just sit down. If you're sitting, or if you're in a bowed position before he comes, then you don't have to bow for him, because there were some opinions. He had an idol, so he couldn't bow. Okay, so you can't bow to the idol. So bend down before he comes. You know, there's all kinds of ways. And they mamish blamed Mordechai for the decree. It's an amazing thing. We don't think about it, but it's the same. We do the same thing now. Okay, so let's see now. So one thing is, let's see. A few little interesting things to see Mordechai's attitude. If you see the next one that's circled is Gimel. The Arachayim says, and he explains that he has a sefer called Rishon LeTzion, and he says, Shabbat Lahayres ki milvad mashalai haya Mordechai mishtachav el Haman. Not only did Mordechai not bow down to Haman kederech shakol hayu mishtachavim lay, like everybody else would bow down, so he didn't just not bow down like other people didn't. He says, hu af haya oise hamtsoes, as he says, he takes it even further. He made a massive deal about it. Lahaydiya she'enei reitze lehishtachavis lay, to let everybody know, I don't want to bow down and I will never bow down to him. However, he made it obvious. And there's many ways, actually, the Medrash tells us. But I just want to show you. He says, Kigoyin, he gives one example. Shahaya Oymet Etzlei Zokov. First, he would stand, Dafki would stand bowed first. And then as soon as Haman would come by, that's when he would straighten up. You understand? It was like obvious. He was making a statement, as he says. V'im haya maita kishahaman avar lefanav, haya kam, he would stand up. Kadei shalai yira shahu mishtachav elai. So nobody should see that he was bowing down. Nobody should have even a mistake and think he bowed down. This was what Mordechai did. Obviously, this was so important to Mordechai that he should make a statement that Haman, you are not going to be able to overcome, to rule over us. We are different, and we remain different, and we have a God. Okay, let's see on the Sfas, let me just see something here. It goes on the top of the next column. Hey, the Maral, he says, Shaloshin osid ba lahayres loshin riboy. When it talks in the future, it's because it's like increasing. It's making it more. He says, V'hainu, sh'asa kach harbe pa'avim. It's not just like you might imagine one day Haman walked by and one day Mordechai didn't bow. No, when it says in the future tense, it's showing us that it happened over and over and over again. Again, this is Dafke, but also it gives us an understanding of why Haman was filled with such hatred and such anger. Because it kept on happening, it was a massive statement. As he says, he didn't bow down. And then the Maharal says even more. He says, in a number of it says, because ki afsha ha-melech lo tziva l'chraya, even though, the truth is, it wasn't from the king didn't command that people should bow down to Haman. Rather, he says, the only ones that the king commanded actually were Ela avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech. If you look in the pasuk, the only ones that had to bow down to Haman were the specific servants of the king who stood at the gates of the king. Everybody else doesn't have to bow down to Haman. So he says, so what could Mordechai have done? V'yichal Mordechai l'shevis b'chadre beis. He could have stayed home. V'lo yilavai al shar hamelech. He didn't have to necessarily come to the king's gate at the time that Haman was going to be there. These people had a schedule. He didn't have to be there then. Okay, so maybe sometimes he was appointed, he had to be there, but not dafka when Haman was going to be there. As he says, im avay dezare shalei with his avay dezare, v'kach lo yoyah machnes asatzmai, so he would have been able to not put himself into ba'isa hasakana, into that danger zone, shehum misarev l'shtachav eslo, that he's refusing to bow. He could have done avoidance. It would have been fine. Mikol mokim rotza Mordechai l'kad but Mordechai wanted to make a sanctification of Hashem's name, to show that he's not bowing, that he only bows to Hashem. That's why Dafka went to be there at the gate. And he would say it with a full mouth, like clearly. Again, this is stressing. Yes, Riva. He did.
So he had to be at the gate.
Okay, so 100%. So what the Maharal is saying, though, it's true, but he had certain hours. You can be at the king at lunchtime when you know Haman's taking a rest. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't have to be, especially as you say, he had a specific job. He wasn't one of the guards, you know? So, yeah, he's like from the cabinet. So that's what, and as we know, we see it now. There are ways, you know, there's ways around things, as we all know, you know, in life. And he just, Dafka didn't take those ways around. That was what he did. But it's a good question. The Sfas Emes says that Shekavanas Haman Haya, Sheachashverish Yitzave Ba'ifenze, Shekulam Yichru Lai, Umardachai Lai Yichra. So the truth is, the Sfas Emes says it goes a little deeper. The truth is, this was really Haman's plan from the beginning. Haman orchestrated it all. He wanted that Ahasuerus should make a decree that everybody has to bow down to Haman. He knew that Mordechai wouldn't bow down because he knew Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him and for what he represents. And he also made sure to put an idol. So Mordechai is definitely not going to bow down. And what would that accomplish? So now he would have a whole plan and a whole method, a whole orchestrated way to get rid of the Jewish people. So according to some opinions, this was what Haman intended, and therefore sometimes it makes what people say even more. So what it looks like is that Mordechai is just falling straight into his plan, right? But Mordechai didn't look at it that way, because to Mordechai, Haman played zero role. Mordechai said, who runs the world? God runs the world. Haman, it has no power. That's how Mordechai looked at it. So whatever Haman, all his evil, crazy, deranged ideas, to Mordechai, it didn't play a role. He knew who was in control. So that's why he didn't take that into account. But that's what Sfas Emes says. Interesting. Another thing also is, a beautiful thing, it says like this, Uba'ayfin na'isaf, this is Tess, Perisha Sfas Emes, ki yesh bay lirmay shela oylam b'chol dar vadar, that forever, in every single generation, nimtza b'klal Yisrael, we find amongst the Jewish people, ish tzadik shela yichra. In every generation, we're going to find that there's going to be those who do bow, but there's going to be at least one, and hopefully one that will inspire others, that will not bow down. And he says, "Ubaze peirush ha'inyan." That's what it means. Shehigidu lahaman es am Mordechai. Right? It says Haman was told the nation of Mordechai. V'hainu shehavin ki af im yomis es Mordechai. So he understood, even if he puts Mordechai to death, Yihye acher bimkaimai. So somebody else will stand up instead of Mordechai and do the exact same thing. Because in this nation, there's always going to be at least one who stands up against the negativity. Shelo yichrav al kein bikesh la'abedes kol am Mordechai. That's why he wanted to destroy the entire nation. That's also why it's in the future tense, because this shows when we say Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachave, we're talking about each and every one of us. We have like we said, we have a part of Moshe Rabbeinu, we have a part of Mordechai. Mordechai was the Moshe of the time. We have it in us not to bow. It's up to us to choose. We have to choose, and something we have to realize, especially now, is the bowing is very figurative. In other words, it's in our mind. A lot of it is in our mind. It's in our perspective. It's how we deal with our day-to-day life. And a lot of times, okay, unfortunately now we are going through a time when we do have an enemy, external enemy. There's no question. But we also have internal enemies, each and every one of us. And we have to be strong and be able to fight all those negative thoughts, all those down things, all those things that tell us we can't do it, you're not going to be able to do it, and there's no meaning to it, and there's no reason, there's no purpose, and what's it all about, and why are you even trying, and all that kind of thing. We have to be able to fight it. And the only way is by being upright, by being strong. And that's what we show here. Mordechai lo yichra, we have it in us, we can. Mordechai gave us the strength. This is the beautiful thing also. That's what we have with as Jews. We know we're not alone, and we know we're not the first one. And we know that we carry the strength of our fathers, grandfathers, great, so many now, so many generations who were able to stand up to all of these enemies. And if they did it, we actually have no choice. We owe it to them to do it, in a sense. So it's quite a powerful thing. And this is what the Megillah means in these words. So it's a very, very important thing to remember when we're reading, again, when we're reading the Megillah. Going to the next page, this is another, oh yes, I want to show you another one. On the next page, I see where I circled Yud Gimel. And he says like this, that the king commanded, why did the king command that people should bow down to Haman? It's very interesting. This is just small, fascinating things of the story. Ahasuerus knew Haman. You know, Haman was a power-hungry guy, right? And he was a little bit afraid of him. He was using him. I mean, he did his, you know, he was, you know how in politics, they use each other. You know, they need each other, each one worse than the other, but they all need each other. So here he says like this. Shaloi rotza Achashverosh Haman yimreid bay. Achashverosh didn't want Haman to rebel against him. Machmas oisa hagdula shu noisim lay, because of the greatness that he's giving him, right? He was worried. I'm giving him so much leeway. I'm giving him my ring. You know, he has so much opportunity to, you know, such leadership. And he was worried. So therefore, Valkein tziva hamelech lo Haman. And that's why, so what did the king do? He commanded Haman, Shemardachai lo yichra velo yishtacha velo. You know what? You need to have one person that's going to remind you that you are not the king. And that's going to be Mordechai. He's not going to bow down to you. And therefore you won't be filled with arrogance. When he will know that there is somebody who is not commanded. Interesting. This is a very fascinating view that says that it seems that Mordechai actually had special permission and he didn't have to bow down to Haman. But it killed Haman, because the whole purpose of Mordechai not bowing down was to show Haman that he's not the top in command. He's only second in command. So that's also why it made him even more angry. It's a fascinating thing. But what we see also, something else beautiful, and this is so true. You see it throughout history and even in our own lives. When we have a certain, how do you say it, a certain principle, a certain value, and we, sometimes it's a bit of a struggle, but we do stand up for it. We do find that other people respect us for it, and they do allow us to continue. Obviously not always, but most of the time, that's what happens. But we just have to be strong within ourselves. So Mordechai had permission, right? He had permission not to, okay, it led to whatever. Haman wasn't happy, but nevertheless, from Achashverosh he got permission, and that's why his job wasn't taken away. Because if you think about the story, if everybody saw Mordechai not bowing down, why didn't Achashverosh tell him, hey, just call him in and say, what are you doing? Because obviously he didn't have to. So you see, it's a fascinating thing. It's up to us to decide. And we can do it if we decide, you know. So it's a very important thing to remember. Okay, then he goes down and he says like this. The big question, as we said before. Why did Mordechai put himself into danger? So he says, why? So look, I'll show you just a few little insights. It says on the top of the second column, Aleph. So the Evan Ezra says, Shekevan shehatmana al yidei hamelech liyais sham. Okay, he actually answers a little bit what you said, Riva. So Evan Ezra takes it on a more simple level and he says, you know, Mordechai was appointed by the king. He had a job. And therefore, he says, he had no permission, asur loilozos. He wasn't allowed to move, mishum, as he says, misham, machmas chay kamalchus, because of the law of the land. So in other words, the Evan Ezra says what you said before, he's appointed, whatever it was, financial advisor, whatever his job was, and he had to be there, and therefore he had no choice. And he had no choice to be there, but he definitely wasn't going to bow down to an idol. So that's one way of understanding this concept. But then the other answers are given. He says, Akedas Yitzchak says, Ki lo yhoya maimer hamelech al shum adam mizera hamlucha ela rak al shar ha'am. Because the truth is, the king's decree, actually interesting, wasn't on royalty, and it wasn't on the higher cabinet members. It was really more on the masses of the people. Because, you know, Haman's an important man, so the ordinary person has to bow down to him. And since Mordechai was so close to the king, he actually wasn't part of that command. That's what it says. The other thing it says is, Kilo heyetziva ha-melech la'am lishtach vayis la-haman, ela shehaman amar lahem. This is a very interesting view, because actually if you look at the words, it almost implies it. It says, Haman told them that the king said. It wasn't really from the king. It was Haman who told them that Ahasuerus says you have to bow down to me. And Mordechai knew that it wasn't true. And that's why Mordechai says, I don't have to bow down to him. It's Babimaisis. The other people are afraid of Haman. But Mordechai wasn't afraid of Haman. So therefore, they didn't even if they knew that it wasn't true, they still bowed. And Mordechai knew that this is not true. Another interesting thing it says on the bottom number Dalit, very interesting one. It says, Shaloi Rotza, Lasa Shum Shinui Ba'atzmai. He says he didn't want to make any change, Mordechai, any change in himself. In other words, I have strong principles, I know what's right, and I'm going to do it. So he says like this. What does that mean? Acha Shaha Yaloi Siman, because Mordechai lived on a whole different approach. Now, what does that mean? It says that Mordechai already, at this point, when Haman was appointed, and he made himself like everybody has to bow down, at that point we know that who was already in the palace? Esther, right? She was already in the palace. Well, we didn't know exactly how things would unfold, but she was already taken. So Mordechai made a cheshbon, and this was his way of thinking. And he said in his mind, he says, Shahayu loy simen, v'chosh, v'yoda, she'ira neis gadol liyisrael al yidei Esther. In his mind, he was sure, he didn't know exactly how, but he was sure that some great miracle will happen to the Jewish people through Esther. Why did he make that cheshbin? Because he said to himself, if not for that, she would never, ever, ever be put into this situation. Hashem would not take such a special person as Esther Amalka and put her into the king's palace, into such a negative atmosphere, and take her away from me unless there was a real good reason for it. So Mordechai was anticipating the miracle. And that's his whole perspective the entire time. And it says, Haya Shayyeh Lai Davar Imzera Amalek Ayvav. And also, he had another agenda. Do you remember who Mordechai is? Mordechai, we know, comes from. It's interesting how it introduces him. It says, Ish Yehudi, but which tribe was he from? Binyamin, exactly. It's really Ish Yehudi, Ish Yemini. It's a funny language. Because when you say Ish Yehudi, you think from Yehuda. But Ish Yehudi, this is the first time, this is where we have us Jewish people called Yehudim. That's what we are called. So that's what he was called. He was an Ish Yehudi, meaning he was a Jew. And why specifically Yehudi and not any of the other Shvatim? So we say the famous thing that even though he was from the tribe of Binyamin, but he also took some of the traits from Yehuda, which is, what does Yehuda mean? As we say, Yehuda is like Maida'ani, the acknowledgement, the gratitude, but the acknowledgement that Hashem runs the world, that there's nothing besides God, that nature doesn't matter, right? It's all about God. It's that focus. That's why you're filled with constant gratitude. You know you get everything from Hashem. You know where everything comes from, that there's no intermediaries. So this was what Mordechai stood for. But who was he? He was from Binyamin. And we know the famous thing. We're talking here about not bowing, right? The famous thing. It actually says in the heavens above, you know, there's all, everything happens on different layers. So the angels, it says, everybody has an angel. And the angels of Haman said to the angels of Mordechai in the higher realms, how dare that he shouldn't bow down to me? Why? Because they said, you know why he should be bowing down? Because everybody, who is really Haman? Haman, we know, comes from Esav, Amalek. Amalek is from Esav. When Esav met Yaakov, right, when Yaakov was returning to meet his father, when he was returning to the land of Israel, we know the famous thing that happened there. Unfortunately, Yaakov and all of his wives and all of his children bowed down to Esav, right? They did. Now, a fascinating thing, it says that Yaakov, when he bowed, in his mind, he was thinking, I'm only doing it externally. But when his children saw him bow, they didn't know that. And they truly bowed. In other words, there was a part of them that felt a little bit afraid of Esav. And that affected them for a very long time, all the way till the Purim story.
I know.
It's a hard thing. But you know, we do it till now, Rushila. That's what we do. We just somehow... that, you know, that goal, that attitude, and in sometimes we have no choice, you know, in a certain way, but we have to inside remember.
That's my master,
exactly right, and this was it was meant to be, obviously, and this is what happened. So now comes the angel and says, "Look, all they all bowed. Why are you not bowing?" So fascinating thing, all of them, all of the tribes were there, right, when they bowed, except for one. Most amazing thing. This was just before they entered the land of Israel. Rachel had Binyamin. He's the only one that was born in Israel. Yes. She had Joseph then, exactly. Yosef was there. He protected his mother. But the one who wasn't born yet was Binyamin. So the angel says to the angel of Esav, the angel of Binyamin says, listen, you're right, except one mistake you're making. Me, I didn't bow. And my Mordechai doesn't have to bow. Interestingly, the one who comes also from, we know, is Shaul HaMelech. He was supposed to kill Amalek. He was supposed to kill Agag. But he messed up and he didn't. And now that's what Mordechai feels. This is Mordechai's strong feeling. He says, my grandfather Shaul, he shouldn't have bowed. He shouldn't have been afraid. And he should have been able to kill every last one of Amalek. But unfortunately, he didn't do the job. So now it's up to me. And that's why he was filled with even more strength and more determination that he's not bowing. No question about it. And that's what's happening here. So Mordechai says, I'm not endangering the Jewish people. Exactly the opposite. By me not bowing, this is the only way we're ever going to get out of exile. The only way is if I don't bow. Because it's only because my grandfather Shaul didn't kill Agag that we are now suffering the same thing again. And we are under the same ruler, his grandson, Haman. Now, I will get rid of Haman. I know I will because Hashem put Esther there. I don't know how, but I know I will. And that's another important thing. In life, sometimes we don't know how. We don't know how things will unfold. How am I going to succeed? It doesn't look possible, but we know Hashem is with us. We have to remember, somehow, Hashem will make it happen, somehow. So Mordechai found a sign. He found Esther. We can all find signs. The signs might not be so amazing. They might not sound look so, you know, but we have to look for those signs. But even without the signs, we have to know that we can do it. And this is what Mordechai's logic is. And that's what he's trying to impart to the Jewish people. Be filled with the pride. Don't think I'm endangering you. It's exactly the opposite. It's only my way that's going to get us successful. And we see it so much now clearly. It's only with the pride. It's only when we act strong that the nations are afraid of us. The more we bow, the more they get rid of us. The more they think they can destroy us. That's what happens, unfortunately. So Hashem should help. We need Hashem's protection. We can't just do it on our own, obviously. But Hashem should help that we should be able to continue to do it, to be strong. I'm not going to go into it. I want to share one more very nice thing about, you know, the mitzvahs of Purim. So we have the mitzvahs that we do. And that was the next part I wanted to do, but I didn't get to. And there's always a big question, why specifically these mitzvahs? So on Purim, we have very interesting mitzvahs. Amongst them, we have Mishloach Manos. We have Matanis Levianim, the giving of the poor. The Mishloach Manos is a very unique mitzvah. We don't have it at any of the other yontifs. What's unique about it? Well, to give a gift to a friend, that's what it is. Mishlayach manais, ish lirei'ehu. We're not talking about somebody who's in need, necessarily. We're talking about a friend, an equal, right? That's what it is. I mean, you could obviously give somebody a need, that's wonderful, but it's an equal, somebody who's a... So it's a fascinating thing. Where does that come from? Why did Mordechai give these instructions? And it actually says that it could even be that the Jewish people did it before Mordechai gave them the instruction. And then Mordechai said, it's a good idea. Let's continue doing this every year, you know, kind of thing. But where does it come from? What's this idea of Mishloach Manos? What's the connection specifically to Purim? So there's lots of different answers. There's one interesting thing that it says that the first year when they were celebrating, that was just after the war, and they were successful in the war, right? And now the danger has passed, and they felt so good and so thankful to Hashem. So it says that they felt in such a, like, happy, such a joy. And you know, when you're in a state of joy, you want to give. And we find that it's interesting, the commentaries say, like, at when we have a simcha, like, for example, when somebody makes a bar mitzvah child, or you make a wedding, or even if you have a birthday, it's true you receive gifts. But, like, as the parents, you know, you also give. You have this feeling that you want to share. Like, you want to share your simcha. You want to give to others. That's why sometimes people actually give something when they leave, you know, they leave a memento for somebody from the simcha. You give. And it's like that feeling, like you want to share the joy around. So that's possibly where it came from. But going just a little bit deeper than that, there's also the idea that we said, l'rei'ehu, friendship. A very quick thing, we know one of the big things that Haman said to Ahasuerus when he went in, when he was presenting his plan to annihilate the Jewish people, he says, yeshnai am echad, there is one nation, mefuzaru mefayre, that spread out over all of your 127 provinces, and this nation is a nation that you should destroy because they're not loyal to you, right? That's what he said to Ahasuerus. And we know, in a sense, he's right, because the Jews are always hoping for to return to the land of Israel and to have, they wanted to be able to rule it themselves, as we know, and that wouldn't be good because now Ahasuerus was ruling it. But nevertheless, the words that Haman uses is mefuzar u'mefayra. They are spread out, scattered amongst all the nations. So the commentaries tell us, just take those words on their own and you'll see something much deeper. Obviously, Haman thinks he can convince Ahasuerus to destroy the Jewish people just because he's going to promise him that they, you know, what's going to happen afterwards? He's going to get all of their money, the Jewish money. He's going to, right? He has all these ways. They're not loyal. But we know that it's much deeper. As we said, everything happens on different levels. What enabled Haman to have the strength to actually get through, right, and be able to make this decree? I mean, if we think about it, it was a disaster. The Jewish people, mamish, were told they were going to be annihilated. You know, we just think of the Purim story as if it happens in a second. But for a few months, this decree was hanging over them. So one of the famous things it says is, as we mentioned before, they had pleasure from the meal. But there's another thing. Another thing is they weren't united. The famous thing, unfortunately, happens year after year, all the time. When Haman says there is a nation that is scattered, he didn't just mean that they're physically scattered. He meant that they're spiritually scattered, that they don't consider themselves one nation anymore. They don't feel that strong sense of friendship, of unity, of oneness with each other. And part of that came because of, like, assimilation, you know, like, exactly, I'm comfortable where I am, I have my neighbors. We have to remember, we only have each other. I mean, they remind us, unfortunately, every few years. Nobody else stands up for us. It's only us that stands up for us. That's all, nobody else, right? A few, thank God, there's always a few. Chassidei u'masailam, right? There are those righteous amongst the Gentiles. They are beyond special. But we have each other, we have to remember. And if we don't have each other, we're really in trouble. And because of that disunity, that's why Haman had the upper hand. And now what do? So on Purim, we remember that. And we say, we better not forget that it is the friendship that is one of the most important parts of our strength as a Jewish nation. And we're not only talking about people who have less than us. We're talking about an equal, another Jew. We have to remember to strengthen the bonds between each other. And that's why Mishloach Manos is such an important mitzvah on Purim. Of course, Matanis Levyanim is also a very important mitzvah, as we know, and in some ways even more important. And where does that come from? So the idea is, because we're filled with such a tremendous joy on Purim, that's the idea that everything was transformed, and therefore we're filled with such joy, we are told, and we know this about every Yom Tov, but Purim even more, is that any time that a Jew is filled with joy and gets together with family and friends to celebrate, as a Jew, we know that you cannot feel a true joy and a true celebration if you know that there is one person out there who has less and won't be able to. And in truth is, in times of old, what they used to do was they used to make sure that people had, even Matanis Levyanim could be money, but it could also be food that people should have for their suda, right? If a family was poor and would, or whatever it is that would make them happy. Because you cannot feel joy when somebody else is lacking. That's the way a Jew is. And Matanis Levyanim also is that concept of unity, but even more, it really zeroes more into the joy aspect of it. It is only, the only way we can have joy is when we give to others in need. That's how a Jew works. And then, of course, we have the Mishteh, the feast. Why the feast? That one's very understood. Because we say the whole decree was made because we enjoyed the feast of Achashverosh. So now we have to show we are enjoying a different feast. And this is such an important thing. I saw such a beautiful thing. It says, I forgot who said it. He says like this, that what we have to remember at the feast that we have, whatever the Suda, however we make our Suda this year, we have to remember something. That the Suda should have, we should have in mind, not only to remember the miracles Hashem did for us in the past, but to be filled with bitachon, with trust, that Hashem will continue to do miracles and He will actually bring us back and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Because that's what counteracts what they did wrong. Because when they were sitting at that feast of Achashverosh, they had given up hope. Right? Well, now we have to sit Achashverosh's feast. We don't have hope anymore. There's not going to be a Beis HaMikdash. We better pander to Him. We have no choice. So to counteract that, we must, at our feast, at our Suda, be filled with incredible bitachon, that not only does Hashem constantly, and He did, make sure that we survived up until now, we know that nobody can ever annihilate us, that's for sure. But not only that, but we will return to Eretz Yisrael in a sense of Eretz Yisrael is there, but we need to return peacefully. It should be rebuilt. It should be with, as we say, with pride, that the Jewish people can be, you know, feel secure and full of pride and full of joy in the land of Israel and every now and today. This year, it's not hard for us. I mean, it's hard for us to even celebrate in a way when you think that there are hostages. So this is the idea that really, as we lead up to Purim, to even daven extra hard, that this year we should be, every Jew should be able to celebrate Purim with a full joy in whichever way they want to celebrate. It doesn't matter, but they should be free to be able to celebrate it. And that's really what it's about. So that's why these mitzvahs are so important, always so important. But this year, even more than ever. And Amir Tz Hashem, it will be.